to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, just a reminder that KABU is in the last week of our end-of-the-year pledge drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $45,000 fundraising goal by becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text kboo to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. A year ago, we let go of 2020 with hopes for a much better 2021, and 2021 started out promising for the first 5 days. Then came the Capitol insurrection, the Republican surrender to total Trumpism, record-breaking weather disasters, disastrous fires, and two new surges of COVID, just as vaccines were giving us hope. But the year was not totally bleak. Today, we talk with inveterate optimist Eric DePlace, until recently with Sightline Institute in Seattle, about the ups and downs of the past year and some surprising victories we were actually able to achieve. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's always good to talk to you.
And happy solstice.
Happy solstice to you, too. It's going to get lighter from here.
That's just a giveaway to listeners that we recorded this on December 21st, and it's not going to be playing on the air until the following Monday, but we have 5 days between this conversation and when the broadcast happens to see how much the world changes. But what we're going to talk about today is looking back at this past year, which I would say is probably been the most disturbing year I've ever lived through. I would have said about last year, but this year seems even more disturbing. However, as I was going through and thinking, boy, this is going to be really a hard conversation, I remembered that there were some really bright moments. So why don't we start with the bright moments and then we can get into the dreck.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting conversation to have. I too thought that 2020 was going to be sort of the low point, and I think 2021 gave it a run for its money. So the bright points of 2021, I don't know, Barbara, what you got to give me a few breadcrumbs here. Where should we start?
Well, let's start with the most recent one, which was the demise of Jordan Cove, which I just did a show about last week.
That's a great place to start. So Jordan Cove, giant liquefied natural gas project that had been slated for Coos Bay, and a little bit like a Friday the 13th movie. I think there were about, you know, multiple three or four episodes of it. And finally, it's dead. It's dead for real this time. The project backer has officially waved the white flag. They've pulled out of that project after losing confidence from the state and from FERC as well. So it's nice to see
that. What project is FERC? Just so people know what FERC
is. Oh, I'm sorry. FERC is the federal regulatory agency that governs large-scale liquefied natural gas projects, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I believe it's called. And so that thing is gone. And so that was another huge victory for the climate and against fossil fuels in Oregon. Really nice to see that one finally go away. A lot of hard work over many, many years by the local activists on that project.
Yeah, it was pushing 18 years. I was using 17. I was talking with Dan Sears yesterday on the show, and he used the term 18 years. And I thought, yeah, actually, we're heading into 2020, and it started in the beginning of 2004. And actually, I think there were rumblings in 2003. So, I mean, I think so much about these people who've spent, I mean, for some of them, it's half their lives. Maybe for some of them, it's three quarters of their lives. And other ones that are closer to my age, it's been a fifth of their life fighting this thing. And just how much, one of the things I really wonder about is how do you switch gears from having this thing you've been fighting for so long, which has taken up all your time, to looking at the rest of the possibilities of your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think the environmental movement has struggled with, and I think the progressive movement has too, is burnout, quite frankly. I mean, we tend to ask a lot of activists and of people who participate in these fights, and it all can feel really urgent. But, you know, I think it's to the extent that we can invest in taking care of people that, like the activists who are fighting this stuff over the long term. Because you might be in a fight for, you know, I mean, I used to think that 2 or 3 years was a long time, but a lot like this, and I think this one may be a kind of a record setter, but still, 18 years is an awful long time to be looking at something. And I think, you know, if the entire thing has felt frenetic and urgent and red alerts the whole time, I don't know how anybody can manage it. But I am hopeful that this sort of movement building we're seeing, where people who are working on Jordan Cove can also see kind of solidarity and similarities with you know, their friends who are working against the Climate Methanol Project, or folks who are working in the Gulf Coast, or you know, folks who are doing other stuff in other places, that maybe there's a little bit of sense of kind of what the other possibilities are like once the one right in front of you is gone, once the one in your backyard is gone, you know, what else is in somebody else's backyard?
I remember you saying a number of years ago in one of our earlier interviews that you love these fossil fuel fights because it brings out the best in communities. And I think we were talking at that time about Vancouver, Washington, and the proposed oil by rail terminal that was defeated by the organizing and community building in Vancouver in particular, and then the rest of Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon. I thought about that statement when I was interviewing Deb Evans, who's one of the landowners who was fighting the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline, which would have fed Jordan Cove. And she said, the best way to bring a community together is try to put a pipeline through it. On the other hand, I mean, it has really brought together a lot of diverse people in Southern Oregon, and that's really inspiring. But I want to talk a little bit more about this burnout thing, because I know I see people who've gotten really burnt out by Jordan Cove and by other struggles. And I wonder what we can do to try to support the people who are facing burnout, so it's not quite as bad.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you know there are some sort of structural problems that are maybe getting better. I think one of them is actually just goes back to kind of what people are paid who work at small nonprofit organizations, a lot of times those wages are, frankly, not where they should be, maybe it works for a few years right out of college. But it's increasingly tough, especially in high-cost cities like Seattle and Portland, for folks to make a go of it, especially if you're coming from a disadvantaged background or from a group that maybe a racial group that doesn't have all the economic resources that I did, even as a middle-class white kid when I was getting into the movement. I think it really limits our movement in some way not to sort of pay more. Of course, there's got to be more money in the pipeline to pay the wages too. I mean, and so some of it comes back to our ability to kind of fundraise and make the case to the people who are donors. I think that's part of it, but you know, I don't know. There's to me the almost the more interesting part of it is the culture that we create as progressives or as environmentalists. We care about this stuff a lot. Like it is, we are not doing this as a hobby. We're not doing this really as a paycheck. We're doing this as a mission in life. And that temperament makes us successful because we believe that what we do really matters and we bring our whole selves to it. And I know I speak for myself and probably for you and many others. Like I wake up in the middle of the night and I feel fired up about it. Sometimes angry, sometimes scared, sometimes happy. But, you know, I also think we have to kind of work against our own temperaments in some ways and take a breath and recognize that, these fights are going to go on way after we're gone. If we don't take care of ourselves, we're not going to be able to win over the long haul. I kind of hate the tired old saw of it's a marathon, not a sprint, but there's probably some juice in that because it's right. It is a marathon.
Well, I think a number of people, particularly down in Southern Oregon, are talking about the importance of celebration. And while they're celebrating knowing that they need to keep moving forward, I think that they're moving forward. Well, there's two parts to it because one person down there told me that he was numb, that it was really hard to get over the numbness. And then Deb Evans talked about how she'd go through a day and she suddenly remember that Jordan Cove was dead and she'd get this exhilarating feeling. And this had been going on for days when I talked to her. So that part, that's the good part of it. But I think that the moment to raise a glass and to just really celebrate a victory really nourishes our spirits. And speaking of victories, there's another one a little closer to you in Southwest Washington. I wanted to talk about that other major victory, which was only, I think, a 5-year struggle, not an 18-year struggle.
That's right. So well, first of all, I think you're absolutely right that taking a moment to celebrate and to raise a glass and to congratulate ourselves and our colleagues who've worked on this stuff really matters. And I think some people in our movement are okay at that, but a lot of us are pretty bad at it. So that should be a New Year's resolution for everyone in the movement is to get better at celebrating and not. I won't out anybody on your show, but I have seen many of our folks. Literally, you know, with the glass raised to celebrate, start strategizing about the next fight. And I love it, but we should finish the glass of champagne first. So you mentioned the Climate Methanol Project in Southwest Washington, just a big and frankly, idiotic project that would have taken a whole ton of fracked gas from Canada, shipped it down to the Columbia River, processed it into liquid methanol, and then shipped that to China in order to make plastics. And after, a comparatively short 5-year struggle, that project is finally put to bed. And like the Jordan Cove project, it's dead for real. The project backers have officially acknowledged defeat. So a big victory and huge congratulations to a community like Coos Bay that isn't kind of in the center of, you know, a blue democratic big city world at all. It's operating in a very different environment. And so really kind of neat to see that those fights successful in those regions.
So how do these two experiences buoy your sense of loving these fossil fuel fights because of the payoff in terms of community building?
Yeah, you know, the reason I still love them is because it kind of cuts, so physical infrastructure tends to sort of cut through the noise. It's less cerebral, it's less theoretical. And all of a sudden people have to make a decision about, well, do you want a physical pipeline on your property? Do you want to see 10 coal trains a day blocking your streets as they're rolling to subterminal? In the world that we inhabit now, where it feels like everything is mediated by a screen or it's on social media, or it doesn't quite feel real, I think when we're confronted with something really tangible and real like that, it does have a clarifying way of, I think, moving communities kind of past our tendency to fall into bickering and to find common ground, not about everything, but common ground about that particular project. And I'm hopeful that that leads to common ground about other things too. To me, I got into this work after spending many, many years, trying to explain why putting a price on carbon would lead to demands later, reduction in demand later on, and, you know, drawing charts. And moving from that world to a world of talking about why oil trains are dangerous was so much more gratifying and, frankly, so much more successful. So I want to keep doing this.
Well, I'm just kind of thinking, kind of looking back, and I'm remembering was one of the first times that I went up to interview you, as opposed to you coming down to be on the show on KBOO. And I was driving up Interstate 5, and I saw this oil train around Centralia, and it was the first oil train that I saw. And I got up to Sightline, where you were working then, and I was mentioning that to you, and you told me about the Vancouver Energy oil-by-rail terminal that was being proposed in Vancouver, which was news to me, and it was pretty horrifying, because I was thinking about, I was actually, at that time, dealing with tar sands and looking back at the struggle to stop the heavy haul corridor from going through Idaho and Montana. And I'm just thinking about how far we've come from the beginning phase of that terminal, where people were saying it was a done deal. And they said that, of course, about Jordan Cove. They said that about Kalama Methanol. What does it say to you that these done deals actually turn into major victories for the climate movement and for communities apart from just politics and environment, just for community building?
Yeah, I mean, I think you really said something profound right at the end there. To me, the victory is a climate victory, but it goes way beyond climate into really getting communities to think hard about kind of how they want to be and what they want. We're a democratic society with a wide range of viewpoints. We're never going to have a kind of a kumbaya moment, but I really do think there's value in communities working through these problems, however much fractiousness there is. It's fun to look back on this stuff with you, because it sort of reminds me of how far we've come to. It's easy to forget. I mean, when that Vancouver Energy Terminal project was first proposed, I remember Brett Vandenhoevel at Columbia Riverkeeper called me and said, you know, look, this thing's going to ship 360,000 barrels of oil per day on a train. And I laughed at him and I said, that's impossible. Like, that's a pipeline. That's a big pipeline. And there's no one would ever do that on rail. But he was right, of course. And in my defense, I laughed partly because that project was so out of scale to anything that had been seen previously. It is interesting to me, like, for some of those projects, Kalama Methanol being one of them, not so much Vancouver, I actually thought we were going to lose. I thought we were going to lose kind of out of the gate, but I figured it was worth fighting anyway. I've been wrong a whole bunch of times, mostly because I've been betting that we're going to lose and then the movement keeps winning over and over again. And so I'm like, after 10 years or however long it's been, I'm slowly starting to change my tune. But I, I do think that there was has been a real galvanizing effect, and maybe I'm just an indicator species here, that people no longer, at least in the Northwest, don't accept anymore that just because the industry or government says it's a done deal, we've issued permits, or they've, you know, we've done this EIS process, people don't buy that anymore. And I think we now realize that we have a lot more power and a lot more ability to really call the question, ask the hard questions, force revisions, and then force them off the table, which is, you know, where they belong. But it's funny how that kind of gradual progress over 10 years can add up to something that's, we're in a really different place than we were then. But it's hard, easy to lose track of it in the moment.
And it's a better place, I would say, too.
A much better place. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're reflecting on 2021, this most trying of challenging years, with Eric Deplace, who is working to build an intellectual apparatus to oppose fossil fuels and advance justice. That's Eric's words to describe himself. I also want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during this final week of our end-of-the-year pledge drive. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Join now and help us to meet our $45,000 goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, Eric, you're spending a lot of time working. I'm not sure you're actually physically being in other parts of the country right now, but you're certainly working a lot in Appalachia. And I'm wondering if you're seeing similar kinds of wins against the fossil fuel industry and that kind of community building in the places where you're working now.
Yeah, I love that question. I am born and raised in the Pacific Northwest and have spent the vast majority of my career working in the Northwest. And over the last couple of years, I've had the great fortune to start working in Appalachia as well. And in 2020, right in the middle of COVID, I was had this really cool opportunity to design and launch a think tank there called the Ohio River Valley Institute. And then was able to hire a staff that is just shockingly talented. And the staff at that institute have just been chalking up what I would call wins in a way that is really pretty exciting. I think everybody probably listening knows that Appalachia is a region that has been pretty firmly enmeshed in the fossil fuel industry for centuries, really, going back to the first, you know, commercial oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania. The history of coal in Kentucky and West Virginia is well known. Steel, of course, in the Pittsburgh region. But I think things are changing for the good. And the team at ORVI, the think tank there, have been really, really successful at demonstrating that the industry's arguments, the main argument they have, the main case that they make for themselves, is that they bring prosperity and they bring jobs and they bring economic activity. And we've kind of been able to go after them on those grounds, on their strongest footing. And in a whole series of articles and analyses that have been widely circulated in the media, make the case like, no, you haven't. They've failed signally. And you look at a county that's been fracking a lot and compare it to a county that's not been fracking a lot, and the fracking county does worse. You look at a county that's building a petrochem facility, compare it to one that's not, the petrochemical county does worse. And so the industry is bringing not just local environmental impact and not just climate harm, but they're actually sucking prosperity out of a region that's already poor. And that resonates with people on the ground. It explains what they see around them. And I'm pretty optimistic that we're going to see some changes in the way that at least parts of Appalachia think about the fossil economy. It has not been a good deal.
Well, what about Joe Manchin? He plays a big role in that part of the world that you're working in right now.
Yeah, I talk to people in West Virginia every day. And I guess I have a somewhat oddball view of Joe Manchin. Here's my perspective. Joe Manchin is the best possible politician we could hope to have in West Virginia. He is further to the left of his constituency than any member of Congress or the Senate. West Virginia voted for Trump by 37 points. The fact that he caucuses with the Democrats is a miracle. The fact that he has passed any legislation with the Democrats is a miracle. And so I think we somewhat over attend to Joe Manchin, the person, who I don't really have opinions about him as a person, and under attend to the fact that West Virginia voted blue in the 80s and 90s and is now deep, deep red. And there is very little attention to building progressive, environmentally friendly kind of soft infrastructure there that would change the dynamics. Because if Joe Manchin doesn't run again, there is a 100% chance we'll have a Republican in that state, and probably a very conservative Republican. And so I think rather than focus on, you know, Joe Manchin, the individual, I think we should focus on what are we going to do in places that have taken a hard turn away from voting for, you know, I don't want to make this a partisan point, but voting for candidates who support, you know, progressive issues and climate protection. And I'm not convinced that our movement has an answer to that. At least I don't like the answers that I've seen right now.
Well, one of the things that I keep hearing is that, and the Democrats are making a big point of this, every Democrat except Joe Manchin, is that his opposing the Build Back Better bill and his opposing extending the child tax credit and all the other things that he's being opposed to are things that are actually really popular and would really benefit his constituents. And I'm wondering if that's true, and then how do we reach his constituents to reach Joe Manchin?
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's the great irony of it is so many of the policies in Build Back Better would clearly benefit West Virginia. It's a poor state. That's not a surprise. It's an aging state. And so, you know, so much of that stuff would be just without question a benefit for the people of West Virginia. You know, there's often a disconnect between kind of the pop and they're popular too. A lot of the policies on their own terms are popular in West Virginia. You know, of course, that's true for a lot of other states that are represented by Republicans, where there would be huge benefits for the people. And the policies may be sort of popular on their own terms, but the officials representing those places aren't interested in passing them. So, you know, to me, I guess it goes back to trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do to make a difference in places like that and change the political composition of places like that? Which is, you know, I think one of the Howard Valley Institute is not working on politics per se, but they are working at the level of kind of culture and narrative and analysis and trying to kind of tell a new story, create a new sort of reality that will lead to those things on a structural basis. I guess, you know, since I've got the mic for a second, I mean, I'll just, I lose heart sometimes because I think we had a pretty bruising round of city council elections here in Seattle recently, and ton of money spent and a ton of vitriol spent. Because we've got, the city's got problems, similar problems to Portland. We've got massive economic inequality. We've got addiction problems and homelessness problems. We've got, you know, billions of problems. And actually, the easiest way to solve those would be to have better congressional representation in West Virginia. It would be to have Joe Manchin's constituency support, you know, and have him, you know, do something different. But we don't have we spend all this time screaming at each other here in Seattle about, well, why, you know, why are we solving addiction? Why aren't we solving climate change? They're not solvable at that scale. And so what I want to do, and I get grumpy about this, is I want everyone in Seattle to shut up for a second and figure out not how to yell at each other, but how do we go build something positive in Ohio or West Virginia or, you know, a dozen other places like that. That's my mission. I haven't figured out the details yet, but that's where I want to go.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I've been fascinated by the opioid epidemic that is really rampant in Appalachia and has been for, I guess, pushing 20 years or over 20 years. And one of the books that I'm reading right now looks at just the incredible hollowing out of all these communities that used to be thriving small towns. And they were, of course, supported by both textile and coal and steel and other industries that are gone by the wayside. And all that seems to be left is the OxyContin and the heroin culture. So it gives me a sense of just how much we're up against when you're basically dealing with communities of zombies. And I wonder if that's something that the group that you're working with in Appalachia is addressing.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we have not confronted the public health issues as much. You know, if you go to a lot of communities in Appalachia and ask them to rank the sort of seriousness of problems, it's usually economic development and public health, often referring specifically to drug use, is in the top 2, 3, or 4, or 5. I've seen that lots of times. We're not equipped yet to tackle that issue. We have focused more on the economic development side, because I think there really are sort of two, it's a confluence of things. There are, what happened in a lot of Appalachia was what people sometimes call deindustrialization. So you had the collapse of the steel industry along the northern parts of the Ohio River. You had the collapse of the coal industry not long after that in many parts of the region, and you know, tremendous job losses. I mean, you can go to like Wheeling, West Virginia, and it has half the population it did a few decades ago. And so there's been this real hollowing out. And what that means is that, you know, if you're sitting around Seattle or Portland and you own a house and the value just keeps going magically up, if you're in Wheeling, West Virginia, that's not happening. Your value might be going down. So people don't have, they're like, they lost their assets. The kids have moved away. And there's this, I think it's a, there's a sense of despair that comes along with it. And then layered on top of that, you have the Sacklers and others targeting a distressed region with a flood of clearly addictive substances that even, you know, the FDA was denying were addictive in that way. And that's just wreaked havoc on the region. And it's, so it's tough. I mean, there are, you know, really profound kind of structural issues that need to be dealt with at that level. Build Back Better would take a crack at a bunch of those. And it would be neat to see that in place. But again, I think, you know, that means that if we kind of care about those issues, even if we just care about them locally, you know, I think the right thing to do is to figure out how we build that kind of support and infrastructure in the places that don't currently have elected officials representing them that support those issues.
I was reading about the town, I think it's Portsmouth, Ohio, which is right on the Ohio River, right across from Kentucky, eastern Kentucky. And I mean, they can't find a person to be mayor who knows how to run the city. I mean, they don't have any elected officials anymore. And the book I'm currently reading, I feel like it may be a bit exaggerated and melodramatic, but it sounds like OxyContin has replaced cash as the economy. And it's very frightening to be like imagining these communities. And I'm kind of curious about how people who are progressive in Appalachia, who are working to build economic opportunity, knowing that it's much more of a challenge there than it is here in Portland or in Seattle, where certainly we have issues of homelessness and addiction and all that, but it's still, we don't have that kind of level of hopelessness that's so widespread.
That's right. I mean, we have, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, or most of it, we have people moving here from other places. We have an influx of young people, an influx of talent and all that sort of thing. And in regions where that's not happening, I think it's a much more difficult challenge. And I think it's actually part of the reason why when the gas industry or the petrochemical industry shows up and says, we're going to build this facility and it's going to produce 500 jobs, OPS, it's going to contaminate your water and poison your air, people are willing to take the trade. You know, of course, what they do is they don't actually even produce the economic benefits. But, you know, I think the really sort of smart people that I've seen there, and I think the right way to go is to not look for help from the outside, at least not from the private sector. Like the federal government could make some really important investments in that region in physical infrastructure and also social infrastructure. But it's to sort of start with local assets and kind of rebuild based on what's available locally. So it's quality of life issues that begin to keep people or attract people. There are little glimmers of this happening. There's a professor, Amanda Weinstein, who's actually a fellow at the Ohio Valley Institute, who's demonstrated sort of analytically that kind of the best thing for struggling communities like that to do is to kind of invest in their own physical assets and invest in quality of life issues. And that produces then economic growth in a way that you wouldn't get if you're kind of hunting around for someone to come in from the outside and save you with a new manufacturing base or something like that.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're reflecting on 2021, this most trying of challenging years. I'm talking with Eric DePlace, who used to be with the Sightline Institute and who's now kind of freelancing around the country, particularly in Appalachia, doing community building through creating socially aware social justice think tanks. It's also, this is a good time to remind you that KBOO is now in the last week of our end of the year pledge drive, and it's a good time for you to become a KBOO member and help us reach our $45,000 goal. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. So help increase our member ratio and meet our $45,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to kboo.fm, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, let's get on to looking back at this year. And I kind of wanted to start this discussion by looking at what we thought we had learned from 2020 and what we were hoping would be different this year.
Yeah, what a great question. I mean, what I was hoping would happen in 2021, naively, as it turns out, was that we would have a sort of reinvigorated commitment to democracy and a reinvigorated commitment to just basic forms of government competence. And boy, I think we're about 6 days exactly into the new year when it turned out that that was not going to be the story of 2021. So I remain alarmed and appalled by the events of January 6th. But really have only sort of grown more concerned about that as the year has gone on. I think that's true of lots of people. That was something, like, I think if I had written down my time capsule projection for this year, if I had written it down on December 31st, I would have been embarrassingly wrong. I actually thought things were going to take a turn for the better. And I think in terms of democracy issues, we've really taken a turn for the worse.
Well, you know, what's funny about that, because I was thinking as I was working on my intro the other day about how the first 5 days of 2021 were pretty promising. Now, there were these glimmers. We knew there was going to be this pro-Trump, anti-democracy rally in D.C. on January 6th. And we knew that Trump had been pushing what is now being called the big lie starting on November 7th of 2020. So that was rumbling. But when Raphael Warnock and John Ossford were elected to the Senate from Georgia, I mean, that was such a moment of celebration. And actually, John Ossoff was announced the winner just as the rally was getting started in D.C. that turned into the insurrection against the Capitol. So it's a kind of funny take on it. But I think that what we were seeing through the end of 2020 was the hope that we're getting from Biden. And I would say I thought he looked like about 80% really good, which is pretty good for a president in this country.
I'll say.
But there was all this undercurrent that was very disturbing. And then that ugly undercurrent seems to have taken over. I wonder, though, if you see anything positive that's happened, besides what we talked about in the first half hour, that's happened since January 6th, that gives you some hope that maybe things, we can get a handle on the incredible disarray and dysfunction that we're finding ourselves in right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I sometimes read the headlines and I despair, but I don't despair all the time. I mean, it is worth remembering that Congress actually did pass two pieces of flagship legislation, the Recovery Act and then the Infrastructure Bill. Both are huge and important pieces of legislation. I think it's kind of easy to lose sight of that because so far progressives have not gotten everything that they've wanted, particularly Build Back Better, which we really need and should get. And I hope that we get at least parts of it still. I think it's a mistake to not look back at 2021 and realize just how huge those things were and how they did happen on a bipartisan basis. And, you know, frankly, like, I'm not convinced that they would have happened had it not been for kind of Biden's leadership but other leadership too from various parts of the caucus. To the point you were making earlier, we ought to actually raise a glass and celebrate those wins because they're pretty big. And instead, we have tended to focus on what we haven't gotten yet. And now, again, we need those things and they're super important, but it is, I think those are two really important bright spots. And then I think the other bright spot, or possibly a bright spot, is this attention on kind of voting rights. And I am cautiously optimistic that we'll see federal legislation that will then drive state and local improvements, because there are a whole bunch of improvements, everything from sort of gerrymandering to the way that polling places are conducted. The federal government can do a lot on those, and I do think that we're likely to see at least improvement on that score, even if we don't see kind of everything that we should get.
I'm sort of hopeful about that too, actually. And it seems like the Voting Rights Act is now taking front stage for a little while, and Build Back Better is kind of going back to rebuild itself, maybe a little bit better than it was. Because the other thing, I've been reading some interesting commentary, and some people are saying, well, the bill has some problems, and it could be tighter, and maybe there'd be a way to entrap Manchin into actually supporting it if some of the inconsistencies in the bill were taken out. Another thought that I had that was a game changer this year was the conviction of Derek Chauvin, the policeman who murdered George Floyd. And now there's that woman, is it Kim Potter? She's the one who also, as George Floyd's trial, as Derek Chauvin's trial was going on, she killed this young black man for no reason at all, thinking she had her taser. And it's sounding like she's probably going to get convicted too, it sounds like. So there's a big shift in terms of police accountability. Is that something that you're seeing and hopeful about?
I am hopeful about it. I mean, I think it, and it's actually it's a great example of how, time sort of moves on, and it's easy, especially in this COVID era, to forget that it wasn't that long. I mean, we're talking about summer of 2020 when we had the big protests that were first initiated by the murder of George Floyd, and how, fast forward by 18 months, and we certainly have not achieved racial justice in this country, and we certainly have not achieved everything we need to achieve with kind of reform of law enforcement, although there, I think, are some wide-ranging views about what that looks like. But we've certainly moved in some ways in a really positive direction, and I think those convictions are a great example of that happening. And I think the national conversation has changed in a sort of a structural, and I hope permanent, way, where it is no longer just assumed that the police are telling the truth about an encounter like that, and it is no longer just assumed that the use of deadly force is acceptable. And so, now we're having a different conversation about, well, when and under what circumstances, and who gets to say, and how do we handle a situation when it unfolds. And I think it's not, like I said, I don't think we haven't arrived at the promised land, but it's hard to me to see how we haven't made an improvement as a country on that score. So I'm glad you raised that one too. That's good.
Well, now, after being a little positive, I want to go into some of those really dark corners. And I think there's the two things that upset me the most. Well, there's three things that upset me the most right now. And one is the overall condoning of violence. I mean, that's a really big thing. And whether it's just the murders that are happening in Portland and Seattle and every place around the country, I mean, every city, I think, and probably many rural areas have had such a jolt of murders in the last year, much more than in 2020. It sort of started in 2020, but it's gotten really bad this year. And I guess a lot of gang activities going on. And but there's also this political violence that's going on, and the fact that actually, I was thinking in Germany, the anti-vaxxers were threatening to murder this guy who I think is the equivalent of the governor of this particular state in Germany. So it's not just in this country where there's this current of political violence which is being condoned. And we think about was it Lauren Boebert, her Christmas card with her whole family armed? It happened right after the last shooting in a high school. So that is very disturbing. The other thing that's very disturbing, as you're describing, is the ways that we're watching democracy try to be choked off. Though hopefully you're right and the Voting Rights Act will happen and we can nip that in the bud. And then the third thing is COVID coming back. And that's tied to people who refuse still to get vaccinated. So I wonder how we look at these dark corners of this past year and kind of sort out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I suspect that all of those are linked in important ways. I think that, we're already starting to see some of this research, but I think 5 or 10 years from now, it'll be really interesting to look back and see what were the mental health impacts of COVID and the response to COVID, because I think they were profound, and I think that, well, there's no question they were profound, and there were economic impacts too that then magnified the mental health impacts. And My suspicion is that, I mean, there are sort of lots of culprits in what feels like a really alarming increase in violence or violent rhetoric, including, I guess, we hear anecdotes all the time of, you know, school board officials or local, you know, election officials, you know, being subjected to just ridiculous amounts of abuse, which is completely inappropriate. But I, you know, I think my pet theory is that a whole lot of this is driven by this increasingly sort of strange, digitally mediated, isolated world that's often pretty fearful or pretty angry. And the COVID has really accelerated that. And so, you know, I don't think it's the single cause that's contributed to a spike in murders or anything like that, but it's, I think it can't be helping. And I think it has frayed people's own emotional reserves. And I think it's frayed sort of community level bonds in a way that's not good at all. And I don't think we get back to a healthy place until we're back together as people, as humans who can see and touch each other and see each other's faces and smile or frown or whatever. I despair that we are wired as a species to figure this out over screens. I don't think screens help us really very much at all. You know, I'm a Luddite, I guess, on that score. And I, on a personal note, I mean, watching Omicron scale up and watching what seems to be another surge in potentially overwhelmed, hospitals and emergency care facilities is just soul crushing. Like, I can't deal with another winter of this nonsense. I'm sure I speak for a whole bunch of people listening to this. I just don't know how we're going to get through it. I mean, I feel, you know, very fortunate about my own personal situation, about my family situation, but oh Lord, like, can we really do another winter of this? You know, and I think it's not just people who have chosen not to get vaccinated. It's that we've got a lot of people on Earth who haven't had access to vaccines. And that may also be a big thing. So we've got to figure out how to manufacture and distribute just a huge number of vaccines and get it right the third time around or whatever this is now.
Well, it seems like Moderna has to kind of back down from its intellectual property rights angle and just become generous and realistic, because I think that's part of the thing. It's not just making enough vaccine. I think we can make vaccines, but it's important that these countries that have such low vaccination rates because they have such low amounts of vaccine available to them don't have the infrastructure. And if they were helped with building the infrastructure and Moderna would give them the formula, basically, I think that, like, particularly Africa would be in much better shape than it is right now.
I completely agree. Completely agree.
As you say, you don't want to go through another winter. This is going to be our second and a half winter of COVID. I've been thinking about how I'm dealing with it, and I've been questioning myself about it, because I had all kinds of plans to kind of go back to normal once I got my booster in October. And so, KBOO, we're back. I'm part-time live from the station. I'm doing interviews like you with you that are long distance still over Zoom, but the ones that are local people, I'm in the station, and I feel like KBOO has a very good COVID protocol and I feel comfortable there. But I'm starting to socialize a little bit more. Actually, we've been socializing all summer in safe ways, but it's the holidays and there's two events that have been traditional for us on New Year's Day. And we're doing both of them in person this time, and with, I think, a lot more comfort and with one event with many fewer people. But I've been thinking about it and thinking, well, are we crazy? I mean, this is the kind of stuff I was very critical of people doing last year. But this year, I guess I'm feeling that the nurturing that you get from that close contact is as important as also staying isolated and safe. And so I think a lot of us are creatively trying to find ways to balance the two things. I'm wondering what you're doing for your personal celebrating in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I think mental health is a part of health, and we have to factor that in and balance that with our physical health and our risk, you know, across the board. So, I'm getting together with my family for the holidays. They're all local. So I won't be getting on a plane for the holidays, but I am actually getting on a plane after the holidays, I think. I went to a cocktail party this last weekend, and I went on a date with my girlfriend the next night and in a crowded restaurant, and it was great. And it felt really good to be out in the big city where I live and to enjoy being around other people, including a bunch of strangers. And, you know, I don't know. I certainly don't want to contribute to an escalation of a public health crisis And I don't really feel like apologizing for it either. And I don't know what people are supposed to do if they can't gather together with their loved ones and with the people that they share a community with. You know, what are we here for at a certain point? So I'm vaccinated, I'm boosted and all that kind of stuff. And I hope everyone around me is too. So I really think we're going to have to go through, and I think we're going through it, some new way of thinking about risk and impacts and trade-offs, because there isn't a scenario, in my judgment, where we get nothing but benefit and all and no downside. We're going to decide what trade-offs we're going to make. And, you know, as a parent, I'm terrified of them closing the schools again. I mean, that was a disaster for kids. It was a disaster for parents. It was, in my opinion, the wrong solution that was not particularly well grounded in the science. I don't know, maybe some other people disagree with that assessment, but open, keeping them open is a trade-off too. Like, it does probably increase risk by a little bit. You know, so how do we think about what's the greater good? What's the social good? And, you know, who wins and who loses? But there's, I'm getting very, very tired of people who sort of talk like there's a solution that's the right one and it doesn't come with any downside. Cause I just think that's nonsense. Now I get to rant on your show, Barbara. Thank you for inviting me on.
Sure, anytime. Well, you're listening to the land of ranting. You're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations, KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're reflecting on 2021, this most trying of challenging years, with Eric DePlace, who used to be with Sightline for many years and now is off on his own. And it's also time to remind you that KBU is in the final week of our end-of-year pledge drive, and we're striving to make $45,000 to reach our goal. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBU. And KBU is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland. So please support this vital community institution by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBU FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I think that there's a difference between now and last winter, though. It's really different, and that might be fueling some of your ability to take some risks, and maybe mine as well. And that's that we know an awful lot more about this virus than we knew a year ago, and certainly more than we knew a year and a half ago. And there's things that we don't need to be afraid of, like library books, which when they finally opened the library, you'd return your book to the outside vault and drop it in, and they would let it sit for 2 weeks before they actually put it on the shelf. Or doorknobs aren't so scary anymore. Nobody's washing their food, as far as I know, when they bring it home. And so we know more about the way the infection is spread. We have vaccinations, which maybe aren't going to completely protect us from getting infected, but may really help making it sort of like getting a bad cold, which we can all live with. And so I know before the era of COVID, I was going to KBU every week, talking into this microphone with this rubber windscreen, which was just full of germs and bacteria. And I've attributed that most of the colds I got over the last 30, 40 years were from KBU probably. So I think that having a little bit more knowledge gives us an opportunity to think through our decisions. I'm wondering if that's something that you've thought about.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. I think that's probably right. And I don't know that I would have put it in just those words, but you know, I think it does sort of again raise this question of like, you know, how, like, there's something positive about a crisis, like any crisis like this. And I know this sounds a little canned and a little corny, but like, because it does give you an opportunity to sort of like re-examine the whole picture. Like, why do we conduct our lives this way and not this other way? And I think it's yielded some sort of surprising results. I mean, you just named a couple of them. I mean, one thing that I've heard from a lot of folks, and that I work in a home office, and actually almost all the work I do is on the East Coast. You know, a lot of people miss their commutes. A lot of people hated their commutes, and now they wish they had them back. Or a lot of people, you know, not everyone, of course, but, you know, kind of miss the office that they were sort of annoyed by in the beginning. And so, you know, and then, of course, there are some things that we probably are just going to jettison forever, and that's probably fine, too. And, you know, it sounds like the exact setup you had at KBOO was not a good one from a health perspective. So I'm glad to jettison that. You know, speaking just for myself as a relatively healthy person, in my 40s somewhere, I would happily take a couple of wintertime colds in order to be spending more time with people and to see my city back alive again. There, some neighborhoods are doing great, and some places, especially downtown, are just really grim. And I've been downtown a couple of times in Seattle recently, and it was just odd. I mean, it looks like Blade Runner, these huge vacant buildings and street activity that is nowhere near where it should be, you know, especially around the holiday season. I found that a bit disheartening, and I don't have any idea if it'll ever come back at this point.
Well, interestingly, I've been downtown in Portland quite a few times, and the last few times I was down there, would say in the last 3 or 4 months, though there's still quite a bit of homeless camps on the streets in downtown Portland, there's a lot more street activity of the more typical kind of commerce and people who are healthy and out and about. And I was reading, I guess, in the Oregonian that the Christmas holidays busyness of downtown is pretty much normal. People are downtown shopping, which is great. I mean, that's not just a thing about COVID, but it's like the whole, so many cities, their downtown is hollowed out and there'd be no place to do Christmas shopping. So I have a feeling that Portland's starting to do better in terms of its downtown. The neighborhoods, many of the neighborhoods have been very vital. I mean, I know the one that I live in is particularly fortunate, and we've lost some businesses, and actually we've gotten a bunch of new businesses as well. So I see that we're on this funny fulcrum where things could get better. And the other thing that makes me sort of hopeful is reading more about the Omicron variant today. And there are some theories, if you look at the history of virology and how viruses develop, there's a certain point where they have to stop killing everybody because then they can't survive themselves. And it's seeming like the Omicron, even though it's really infectious, is not so deadly. So does that give you some hope?
It does, actually. I mean, it is heartening to see that as the research emerges, it looks like especially if you're vaccinated, it's not that dangerous. And so hopefully, you know, it's clearly spreads quickly. So maybe it just washes over us like a big sort of ineffective wave. And it gives us more time to, you know, improve vaccination rates and improve other sort of public health measures. So I'm hopeful that, you know, it crests and recedes pretty quickly. You know, I think that's really good news if it turns out to be that way. I hope it doesn't foul up everybody's holiday plans. Sounds like it may be already. I know some folks in who work in healthcare who are pretty daunted by what they're seeing right now. And we owe them our continued support. They've been working really, really hard for a long time in difficult circumstances. So I wish we could do something more. I do worry a lot about burnout in that field. But I think there's a silver lining there probably. And that's good news.
Well, one last question. What do you hope for the next year?
I hope that we get at least pieces of Build Back Better in, however that emerges, whether it's a single bill or a bunch of different bills. I hope that we get something that deals with some of the structural issues in American democracy and improves voting access. And, you know, kind of beyond that, I hope that we can start to return to some semblance of sanity as an American culture, something that's less based on screaming at each other and more based on figuring out how we can build for the long term. And I really like the way you started the show where we were talking about Jordan Cove and about the duration of that the activists worked on there, 18 years to accomplish that huge win. And I think, you know, if we can sort of put our phones down and step away from the screens a little bit and think about, you know, what we're going to commit ourselves to for the next 18 years or what we will commit ourselves to for the rest of our lives and kind of the positive changes we want to see. I'm not giving you a specific, I'm giving you like what I hope is a practice that we can all adopt, including myself. To sort of take that long view and figure out what are we gonna try to build that's gonna last 18 years from now or won't pay off for 18 years from now. I may actually put that on my New Year's resolution list, Barbara, and I'm gonna give you credit for it. So thank you for prompting the question.
Well, thanks for talking to me today. It's always wonderful to talk with you, Eric, and it's nice to sort of have this end of the year tradition where we can look back and look forward. So I look forward to next year doing the same. And hopefully we'll talk before next year as well.
Yeah, likewise. I'm looking forward to it, Barbara. And happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, Eric. We've been talking with Eric DePlace, formerly with Sightline, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us during the last week of our end-of-the-year pledge drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Help us reach our $45,000 goal. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting Community Powered Radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Robert Liberty, chair of the Columbia River Gorge Commission, about new plans to build a super freeway across the Columbia River. We'll go out with New Year's Eve by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening and have a good new year. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
The door was open, I was seething. Your mother burst in, it was freezing. She said, it looks like it's trying to rain. I was lost, I felt seasick. You convinced me that he left. You said keep talking, but don't use any names. I scolded your driver and your brother. We're old enough to know how long you've been hooked. And we've all sounded like fireworks turned out to be just what it was. The stars looked like diamonds, and then came the sirens, and everyone started to cuss. All the noise was disturbing, and I couldn't find on at the same time. And then I hit your car key.